Hello out there. This is The Thing About Cars, coming to you from Atlanta, Georgia. Around the table, we've got Dave.
Dave, you there?
Yeah. And Ben.
Hello there.
Hey.
That was Dave and Ben. Don, are you with us?
I guess I am.
Okay, now we have to investigate that. And Becca, are you there?
No.
Okay, Becca's not there. Don, are you all right?
I'm fine. It's just been one of those weeks, you know, where all you want to do is escape in your vehicle and just put your credit card in your back pocket and don't look back. That's been my week.
I feel the same way, but I would get in trouble if I left the kids behind. Apparently it's neglect or something. I don't know.
Well, I can defects.
Luckily, cats can fend for themselves for a few days, and so can husbands.
Right. So I mean, nothing is wrong with the cars, right, Don?
Oh, my GL is just being fussy pants. I've got a weird sensor problem in the front when it rains. You know, the cars are amazing when they tell you somebody's coming and somebody's in your blind spot, but when they malfunction, you just want to rip their throats out because it just beeps every when it rains and I get near an object, it just goes off for no reason. It's strange and bizarre. I've looked for leaves. I've looked for a bunch of different things. And then my windshield wipers decided to, the hose has detached. Oh. And now I'm waiting for a part for that. So it's just, it's little things that go, come on, this is a luxury car. It's supposed to be enjoyable, not annoying.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I saw something similar with the rain with I believe it was a Nissan Maxima that I had on one of my business trips. Just the mere presence of water on the front of the car would fake out its, you know, collision sensor.
Oh, good grief.
Yeah.
As long as it's not setting off your airbags, I guess that's better.
But right.
Technology is wonderful when you can't tell it's there, right?
Yes.
Technology is fantastic if it remains transparent.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, it remains invisible. Not transparent, invisible.
Invisible.
Yeah, life is much easier when you just do it the old-fashioned way, like turn on your windshield wipers.
Or hit something.
Well, no, I use these things called mirrors. Yeah, I mean, it's a remarkable invention. I look in them and see if there's a car there.
My collision sensor just went off. How can you tell? Well, there's an 18-wheeler in my front seat. All right. So I've got Grand Trivia Auto for us. In fact, I've got a couple things that we could just talk about before we ask the actual official question for today. What was the, in fact, just for conversation's sake, what was the first additive added to gasoline and in what year did they add it? Did anybody want to take a guess?
Was it ethanol?
It was not.
Was it lead?
It was not lead either. No. Well, actually,
was it lead?
No. Actually, Dave is correct. It was lead, but it wasn't just pure old lead. It was tetraethyl lead. And TEL, the first commercial quantities of TEL were sold in February 1923 in the form of ethyl premium gasoline. In 1923, GM set up a special chemical division to market the new additive called tetraethylled. And what shocked me was that it was 1923 when they did that. I thought it was going to be earlier. I didn't know that you know, it was a tetraethylled and not some other lead compound that was in gas, so...
Doesn't tetraethylled sound like a Game of Thrones character that gets killed off early in the episode?
Actually, I was thinking it sounded like a Snuffleupagus's cousin.
Tetraethylled, yes, exactly. So, psychedelic band name from the 70s, maybe.
Exactly.
Right, okay. So our official Grand Trivia Auto question for today is, on most modern high-volume passenger cars, if a brake line leading to one of the calipers or wheel cylinders is compromised, i.e. it gets broken or it rusts through, which brakes will still work? And what is this style of brake system called? So let's think about that. It's sort of a complex, a little more complex than our usual question, and there's no multiple choice here. Do I need to read the question again?
Well, just define the high-volume passenger cars. Is that what you're... Not an SUV.
Not well, you know, high volume passenger cars means, I guess, not a motorcycle, not a two-seater or a roadster or something like that.
Oh.
A mass-produced consumer automobile.
Exactly.
Of some kind.
Yeah. Right. That's exactly right. But if you guys hate this question, then tell me that and I have a spare question. It is
we'll noodle this over.
Yeah, we don't have to love them all.
We'll see if the brake failure makes us run into anything.
That's fantastic. So we released an episode last week, a really short teaser episode with the recording of my friend Claire, who confessed that when she bought her first car, she would check her oil cans for dents and bulges in them to avoid botulism. Right. We have another friend who responded to that and said that early on in her days, someone convinced her that her VW Beetle from the 70s needed a new water pump, and he drove her to the auto parts store so she could get a water pump for her 70s era VW Beetle. And I just thought that was also hilarious.
Wow.
Yeah.
You might have to explain that to some people listening, though.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. And, you know, if anybody who knows about the original VW Beetle engines, they were all air-cooled. There was no water cooling system in them, so there could be no water pump for an air-cooled engine. It just didn't exist.
I would love to have heard the case he made for needing the water pump, what symptoms and such he was, you know, looking at.
And where did he put it?
Right. Well, that's a pretty serious, because it was intended to be a joke, right?
Exactly, that's correct. It was intended to be a joke. That's right.
So that's a lot more serious than what we used to do, having people go to the auto parts store for blinker fluid or things like that. So I'm really hoping the auto parts store at least informed the owner of the Beetle or something. Oh,
I'm sure they all had a good laugh about it, and when
then
you
they
go
sold
to
her an air pump.
Exactly.
They're like, here's a can of compressed air.
Yeah, they're like, hook this up to your friend.
Well, and VW themselves, you know, had a sense of humor about it, because at one point, I believe in the 60s, they ran an ad about how you know their car isn't named after a fish because it, you know, has no water in it. You know, this was the era when you had, you know, things like marlins and barracudas and mako sharks.
Right, exactly. Dave, let's talk about midlife crisis cars. In the past, you've said that the Jeep that's in your driveway now is like your second or third midlife crisis vehicle.
It is. It's the latest in a long line of midlife crisis cars. It's the car I should have bought when I was like 24.
Yeah.
But you know, the last time I was on, I think I confessed that the car I bought right out of college, I sold a Mustang to buy a Ford Tempo, which is really.
What?
It's a really emasculating thing to admit. But you know, it's like that last time the topic of midlife cars or midlife crisis cars came up a couple of times, and Mickey and I were texting each other last night as I was looking around, and I found three just great websites that I spent the evening on. You know, and like one of my favorites was cars that scream, "I'm having a midlife crisis."
Right. Right, and there's some good cars on that list.
There are some cars that you know, like, so one of the ones they put on there, number four, is the Dodge Viper, and you know, the Dodge Viper yes. has that incredible spoiler on the back, and I don't get arrogant on things very often, but I'm an aerospace engineer. I can tell you that spoiler on the back is doing nothing except for compensating for some physical shortcoming.
I think the length of the front end of the car does the same thing.
It does.
When it comes to midlife crises, it might be kind of like the peacock tail, you know, something to wag at chicks or something.
So the Viper is a peacock feather. Is that what you're saying? The spoiler on the Viper?
The spoiler on the Viper is a peacock tail. Yes.
So really, Dave, that spoiler doesn't accomplish anything for that car?
You know, I'm hard pressed to believe that car has such a lift problem. You know, it sits less than like 2.3 centimeters above the ground.
Right.
So, you know, that if it's got that much of a lift that they have to push down on the back of it that hard, then it's seriously forward loaded. I'm not sure how that thing, you know, would make it over a speed bump, much less, you know, on the Autobahn.
Exactly. Exactly. I've only ever seen spoilers on track cars anyway, on track Vipers. Does seem sort of unnecessary.
Well, and the infamous rear wing of the Lamborghini Countach in the 80s was also a styling abuse. You know, that car had, you know, no need to generate that much downforce, even with the heavy rear end it had.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it still had enough cornering grip, what little there was, because it was never a really that great handling car, but Yeah, I mean, downforce for cornering grip is something that, you know, road cars, yeah, don't really need that much help with if right. you're driving legally.
Keyword, legally.
Legally.
Yeah. So, well, Becca, sorry, Dave, go ahead. Or Don, who was that?
Oh, no, it was Don. So I was going to say, speaking of the trifecta of air-cooled, midlife crisis, spoilers, the 9/11. Somehow I was going to pull that Porsche 911 in here because it has.
It's a segue. It's a segue. It works.
It is. It is. And I was, you know, doing some research about my 60s love of cars, and that Porsche 911 had a big transition. Well, not a big, but a nice transition in 66 to the 160 horsepower 911S. And I would love to have that car.
Yeah.
Literally the 1966.
Yeah, who wouldn't?
Would be really fun to have. But I don't think that had spoilers on it. They came later.
I think that car has your name all over it, Don, and I think it you does. Should get one.
I think I should. I wonder if it comes in a crack cabriolet. I've only seen the hard tops. So. Yeah, I've only seen the hard tops. I think the 80s is when the cabriolet came in.
So how much is that vehicle running in these days?
I'm going to have to do a little search and let's find out. But yeah.
We should all start saving.
Yeah, it would be a nice birthday gift for me next year.
Yes, we'll do a GoFundMe thing.
Exactly, because I'm hitting double nickel. So, you know, next year is a big car year, supposedly.
No. I tried to do a GoFundMe for that Bronco a couple years ago. That didn't get very far.
Wait a minute. I don't recall this. Tell us about this, Becca.
It was before I got the Jeep. Remember, I originally was trying to get a Bronco, and there was one way out. Bremen. It was out in Bremen, Georgia.
I remember now.
Yeah, and it was $4,000, and I did a GoFundMe, and I should have just gone the route that, actually, I don't think I could have gone the route that I went with the Jeep because of its age.
Well, so a fixer-upper would get me $40,000, or if I want a completely restored one, we're talking in the 120s.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Well, I hope your friends are better than mine. I couldn't even get $4,000 for a 1985 Bronco, so.
Yeah.
What were you about to say, Dave?
I was going to say, but that's one hell of a GoFundMe.
Now,
having turned 55, you know, this does fit in with the idea of midlife crisis. You know, that women can have midlife crises too, so maybe that's the angle you go from. It's like, yeah, there's more to middle-aged, you know, masculinity is not just measured by belt lines and receding hairlines at midlife. What's the angle for a woman's midlife crisis?
9/11, 1966.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now
I say, why wait? Life is way too short to wait until midlife to have your midlife crisis.
I started working on mine at 24.
There you go. Exactly the way to do it.
What are you about to say, Ben?
Well, to circle back to the cabriolet thing, yeah, from what I'm finding, that did start in the 80s. However, 1967, just 1 year off of this dream car, was when they introduced the Targa. So if you're willing to compromise a little bit on the open top, there's that.
That's
there
right,
is the Targa. Yeah, and they're only in the mid-60s, so there you go.
Only.
Sweet. Only.
Only.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So I noticed this thing that Dave sent to me last night. It's literally titled Women Want Midlife Crisis Cars Too. And I have to note that the first car they show in their illustrations here happens to be a Mustang.
Okay. No. In that case, I've been having a midlife crisis since I was 16.
Yeah, well, it's possible.
That's what I was going to do. Sorry, I had a joke for your, more or less a joke for your midlife crisis thing. It's true, but it's funny. When I was a kid, I always thought that convertible tops caused men to go bald because any convertible you saw with the top down, there was a bald man in it. And I thought the wind was coming over and pulling his hair out.
Oh, wow.
So I always thought it was a convertible top causing
it. We're just shaving the head because we don't want to get whipped around in the face with long hair. That's all.
In teaching my class, that's an exact sample of correlation and not causation.
So, Dave, what else came out of that that article, Women Want Midlife Crisis Cars Too? Did it say anything about what that means in terms of car choice?
Well, you know, actually, the thing that really caught me is the teaser line. So the article on Women Want Midlife Crisis Cars too. It came out of the Detroit Bureau. And when I was just Googling around midlife crisis in cars, their teaser line that they've got on their website to for you to click through, women are more likely to want an SUV for their midlife crisis car. Perhaps like a Mercedes AMG GLE 63.
What?
And I'm like, that literally describes no woman in my life.
No, that's bull.
No, I'm offended by your article. I'm leaving.
I will take that car and use it as a utility vehicle any day if anybody wants to give one to me, but that's no life crisis.
Or take the car and sell it and buy the thing you want.
My Porsche 911. Mm-hmm.
There you go.
I'm looking at that article now, Dave, and it says, asked for their favorite makes and models, the Ford Mustang and Chevrolet Corvette were the favorites. It's unclear if that's because both models have undergone makeovers or what, but the next sentence catches my eye, and I have to read it. It says, curiously, women want that flashy red paint job.
No.
For men, the choice of color, the color of choice is black. And I'm like, really? Flashy red? Is that what women really want?
No, I have an aversion to red cars. I find it to be cliche.
Dawn, what do you think?
Well, I love orange. So my Porsche would be orange.
But that kind of yells, hey, cop, over here. Over here. Look over here.
If I can afford to have that car, I can afford to say, hey, cop, how you doing?
Until you get 15 points and you'll be on the bus.
And we shouldn't stereotype here either she'd kill me if I said it was a midlife crisis car because I don't believe it is. My own wife, Jennifer, has a really beautiful Dodge Challenger, but it's not red. It's not a bright color. She didn't want a bright color. It's a color called Maximum Steel. It's a dark metallic gray.
And I love the gray cars. Yeah.
They can look pretty good, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There was a Ford one. I had an 02 Mustang that was called Mineral Gray, but it was more of a brownish. So the earth tones, I like it. They're not the normal, or hadn't been, at least back then, the normal colors.
Right. The last thing in this article that Dave says, the DetroitBureau.com article, it says the term midlife crisis was coined by a Canadian psychoanalyst, Elliot Jacques, back in 1965. So we've had that term since the 1960s.
In the 60s produced a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Go ahead, Dave. What are you about to say?
I said, including me. I was born in 65. That, you know, I'm wondering what that says about, you know, because my parents had me very late in life. They had two kids in the 40s, stopped, two kids in the 50s, stopped. And then they fired up the factory one more time, and I snuck in just before menopause.
Oh, my goodness.
That's too funny. I'm a 60s baby.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Me too.
Yay, I get to be young on this episode. Yay!
What else do we need to say about midlife crisis cars, Dave? I wanted to give Becca a little bit of a hard time in your original article, 10 cars that scream, I'm having a midlife crisis.
Wait a minute. Why are we giving Becca a hard time?
Number three on the list is a Ford Mustang GT350.
Why is that a midlife crisis car?
It's a two-door sports car that screams like a bat out of hell. That's why.
It's a freaking awesome car. Why?
Right.
Well, it's when you scroll through the list, some of them are awesome cars. I'm not sure that I really think Mazda MX-5 Miata is a midlife crisis car, mainly because I had a friend who was 6'6" and actually bought a Miata. And he couldn't he would wear boots. He's like, I can't wear boots because I can't actually fit underneath the wheel of that car.
I was going to say, that Miata, you have to be like 4'2" to really enjoy it. It's, and good for that person that can enjoy it. But I've been in Miatas and they're uncomfortable.
Yeah, they can be.
Yeah, I have a friend who drives one and she is just not a tall person. She loves it though. But I should qualify that by saying she doesn't drive anymore. She had two accidents in 2 months and decided that she was going to do without a car forever.
Yeah.
So,
No, I've ridden in a Miata once and I really just felt like fodder out there. I was waiting for someone to run us over I felt so tiny and insignificant on the road that no, I need something.
You got your midlife crisis SUV?
Are we referring to a Jeep Liberty as a midlife crisis car? Seriously?
Well, it is an SUV.
Yes. that's a 4x4. Does that, I don't know if that does anything to it, but we're talking about a Jeep Liberty here. It's not like it's an Escalade or, you know, anything big and fancy or.
Well, there's one other thing on this list, the Ford Raptor. Is that a midlife crisis car?
I really don't care.
Really?
That is a beautiful, if I'm not a truck person, but if I had to pick a truck, and yes, there is a Shelby version. Let me just say it. There is a Shelby and it is a beautiful truck.
Huh.
I always thought the Raptor was more of a male inadequacy vehicle, but yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that I didn't think I never associated it with midlife crisis as much as testosterone replacement treatments.
Yeah, and I figured, you know, if a redneck wins the lottery kind of thing, I don't know, because, you know, I live out here in Woodstock where we all have pickup trucks. So
right, I confess, I saw this early video of an early Raptor that was doing a jump, and when it landed, it's like the entire front end got ripped out from under the truck. It did not survive the jump, and ever since then. I mean, I know, I'm sure Ford fixed the problems or whatever it was. It was a major marketing snafu for them when that video went viral. Ever since then, I just can't bring myself to look at that truck and take it seriously.
So was it not the Baja edition that you watched jumping then?
No, I'll try to find the video and post it to our page when this episode goes live. But this thing jumped, and I can't remember what happened. I can't remember if the truck frame broke or if it just the front end suspension fell out or what. But it did not go well for the truck.
Were other trucks doing the jump and they made it okay?
I don't know.
Well, that would be a good thing because, you know, yeah. The wrong jump will kill any car. But right.
Dave, there's one other article that you sent. Should we save it for our next episode or should we tackle it now?
We can save it for the next one. Okay. As a teaser, it was the 25 midlife crisis cars that are affordable.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So next time we'll do the midlife crisis on a budget.
Midlife crisis on a budget. Excellent. We'll save that for our next week's episode.
Is that a Civic with a big wing on it? Sorry.
Ben, there was a question you had posted, or at least not posted, that you had seen on Unloved Autos. And for folks who don't know, that's the Unloved Autos group on Facebook. And the question was, how do the television shows do custom cars in 1 week where it takes a normal person to do them much longer, like years? And that was the question. Ben, you want to take a stab at that first?
Well, sure. I mean, the short answer is because they don't exist in the real world. the shows, I mean, not the cars.
Right.
You know, they're produced. It takes a lot longer to make the show than it does to watch the show. And because they're, you know, nationally televised things, they become advertising vehicles for the providers of the parts. Right. So, you know, if you contact, say, you know, American Racing, say, hey, when my TV show needs some wheels, you know, they'll have them to you in 24 hours, or they'll make it look like 24 hours on TV.
Right.
You know, everything that goes into a car made on a TV show is planned and choreographed. It's not like, you know, when you're a hobbyist at home going, okay, well, what am I going to do at this point in the project? And 3 months later, you're saying, well, what am I going to do at this point? Because you're not choreographing everything finally and planning it ahead of time, you'll run into things that the TV guys don't. Like, I have a friend who has been working for many years on a VW bus. It's beautiful red and white. It's going to be mostly stock, except that it's going to be on wider wheels and sitting about 2 inches off the ground. It's a 60s model. But one of the things he ran into in this regard was he was trying to get some sort of woven floor mats give it kind of that tropical tiki look. And it's an existing product, but it still took him 6 months to get them.
Wow.
Just because the supplier wasn't ready when he was. You know.
Well, and like you said, to your original point, it's television. It's not quite reality. Yeah. And if you look at, like, if you look closely at shows like, what was the name of that guy?
Fast and Loud.
Not Fast and Loud is not the one I'm thinking of. The one I'm thinking of
what
is
I'm thinking of.
on Motor Trend, Kindig people.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't know the name of the show, but I know who you mean.
Yeah, and there was another one. I can't remember the guy's name, Dan, out of Virginia somewhere, but they would tell you up front that these things take months, if not years, to do. Like, it would say day number 367 of this build.
Right.
And so, you know, they're editing. They're editing out pieces as they come and get them, which is why the mechanic working on the car is probably not wearing the same shirt
As opposed,
3-minute segment. Yeah.
Say, as opposed to Fast and Loud, where, you know, Richard brings a, pile of rust into his garage and tells the boys, hey, we got to turn this thing around in 7 days.
Right. Right.
You know, I call BS, you know.
Right. Exactly. It's a lie. It's absolutely a lie.
They may actually be somehow doing it in 7 days, but that's because of all that scripting and choreographing and, you know, pre-planning and then adding a big dose of manufactured drama.
Exactly.
Right.
And then all the extra workers that you can't see.
And where, yeah, and supply for like any of those things, unless you've got your own mill shop, how in the world are they getting all of that?
They probably already have it in stock. They've already cataloged everything they need, ordered it. They've got it sitting around and yeah, the drama.
Well, I wonder if they're simply reverse engineering the finished product.
That could be too.
Yeah.
You know, they only pick cars that they can get prefabricated things for. And like Ben says, yeah, they stage it all in advance. So all you have to do is essentially bolt it all together. But I don't know. I hope that answers your friend's question.
I hope so too, yeah.
So, all right. One last thing before we wrap this episode. And that is a statement I heard, which is kind of related to what we just said, which is to never buy someone else's project car. I think I would agree. I mean, the idea that you're buying someone else's unfinished project car could be completely problematic unless you really, really know what you're doing and what you're looking at. I wouldn't take anyone else's like engine swaps or anything like that either. I was going to say for the simple reason is because if that car is not already running and driving and if they're just selling an unfinished product, that you're inheriting whatever problems that they could not solve. So, unless you're sure you can solve them, just avoid it.
Plus, there's no manual. You know, you would have to figure it out. What, you know, what's in here? What parts do I need? What goes where? I've even thought about, I really need to make addendums to the electrical schematics for my vehicles because I always customize stuff. So things are going to be different. yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's it. The wiring harness alone can create, you know, I mean, if you're putting the dreaded LS swap into something else that doesn't, you know, I mean, the wiring alone is going to be a major issue for anybody. So,
buyer's prudence really comes in here because if you're even shopping for projects, presumably you're going to know a little bit of something anyway. Maybe you've got something in mind and maybe you've learned a little bit about it already. And then of course, you know, what it is, will determine whether or not there's a good community you can turn to for advice as well.
Right.
You know, if it's something that there's a million of out there, then, you know, you apply caution with seeking advice. But if it's a smaller, more close-knit community of enthusiasts, then, the advice is probably going to be a little bit better. But, yeah, always. It's like with buying any car, do as much homework as you can.
Sure. Dave, have you ever rehabbed a car?
I have not. I love driving cars. I love all kinds of vehicles. I've never really rehabbed one, but you know, I've had this my Jeep since 2008. And what I love about Jeeps is, Jeep has made it so easy to work on. The aftermarket parts can become like an addiction. It's like Jeep parts are second only to heroin and addictiveness. and as I go out and I can bolt things onto my car, onto the Jeep, and all of a sudden I come in like, wow, I feel butch all of a sudden.
It's true. All right, so, yeah.
I was going to say, I feel butch. Let me just go pop this White Claw.
All right. On that note, let's wrap our episode by answering our Grand Trivia Auto question. And the question was, on most modern high-volume passenger cars, if a brake line leading to one of the calipers or wheel cylinders is compromised, i.e. it gets broken or rusts through, which brakes will still work, and what is that style of braking system called? Anybody want to take a stab?
Sure. The diagonally opposite one, or no, I'm sorry, the ones on the other diagonally opposite axis. In other words, if your left front fails, your right front and left rear should still work, and that's called a dual circuit braking system.
That is essentially correct. The name is not quite right according to what I've read here, but that is absolutely correct. It says, my answer is,
You're answering it before anybody. I was just going to add on to Ben's that I was thinking circuit. So his is along the lines of what I was thinking. But, yeah.
And so I was just going to say whatever Ben said.
Thank you, Don.
Dave, did you want to chime in before I read the official answer?
I'm going with Don on this one.
Yeah. So the answer is, I have it written here for my research, is you're correct. One front brake and one rear brake diagonally to the one that's broken will still function. And that's called a dual diagonal braking system, or a diagonally split braking system. And I don't know who invented it. We need to do some research here to figure out who invented that and who designed it. But
I do know that dual circuit systems, which is a term you will also hear, you know, but the double setup like that did become mandated in the United States. I want to say 1967, but don't quote me on that.
Yeah.
This is something I've run into, you know, with my old Lotus addiction, because the federal cars have it and the UK cars do not.
Right. Now, is this something that still remains true with anti-lock braking systems?
I'm not sure, but probably.
Yeah.
Because anti-lock brakes, you know, don't really, all they really do is vary the pressure.
Yeah.
And Ben, looking at my cars of the 67, the safety requirement was the dual cylinder brake systems.
Oh, okay, cool.
Along with the defoggers, windshield washers, impact absorbing steering columns, and safe door latches.
Right. Very cool. Thanks, you guys. I think this is good stuff. Is there anything else we need to make sure we mention for the show before we wrap?
Seems like a no.
Crickets. I'm going to find the crickets sound effect to stick that in there.
Keep your brakes maintained.
Get your brakes maintained. And thanks, as always, to our friends for joining us for the Thing About Cars. We really appreciate your being a part of our family and helping us out with feedback and ratings. In the meantime, we hope you and yours are staying safe in this COVID world, and we'll see you with another episode in about a week. Take care.
Bye.
Stay well.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.